deal. Alpha has the world's third largest supply of coal, in large part because the company absorbed Massey Energy last year. But sharp drops in the price of natural gas have U.S. power plants shifting away from coal. The company also blames what CEO Kevin Crutchfield calls a regulatory environment that's aggressively aimed at constraining the use of coal. Crutchfield says the company hopes to sell more coal for fuel overseas. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Grim health predictions from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Trust for America's Health. They project that by the year 2030, more than half the population of 39 states will be considered clinically obese. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits stay connected to customers using email marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who has the day off. Our guest, Gaith Abdul Ahad, is an Iraqi-born journalist who spent the past 9 years reporting on some of the most dangerous conflicts in the Middle East. He began in journalism as a translator working with reporters from the British publication The Guardian, who were covering the war in Iraq. He soon did his own reporting on the sectarian war there, and has since spent time with the Taliban in Afghanistan, with al-Qaeda in Yemen, with resistance fighters in Libya, and most recently with rebels fighting the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. His stories paint intimate portraits of those engaged in conflict, and he sometimes paid a price for getting so close to the action. He was captured by the Gaddafi regime in Libya and kidnapped by militants in Afghanistan. Abdul Ahad is now a correspondent for The Guardian, and his reporting is featured in a new frontline documentary called The Battle for Syria. The film gives an up-close look at insurgents fighting government forces in the city of Aleppo. It premieres on PBS stations tonight. Gaith Abdul Ahad spoke to me yesterday from Istanbul. Well, Gaith Abdul Ahad, welcome to Fresh Air. Was it difficult to get to the front line in Syria?
No. No, getting to the front line is very easy. Unlike any other conflict, Syria, and you know, you just cross the border from Turkey, you take a car, you have to wait in different outposts for the rebels until you reach the front line. So logistically, it's very easy. You just meet the rebels and you drive with them. Having said that, it is a very, very tough front line. You know, one of the toughest I've seen. I've been covering wars for the last 10 years. I haven't seen anything like this since Fallujah, probably in Iraq, 2004.
In what way? What makes this particularly striking to you?
There is no front line in the sense of a front line. There is a line defending, people defending the line, people attacking, people coming back. It's a very, very fluid situation. People are fighting over, you know, streets, alleyways. They move from one building to the other. So the whole concept of front line is misleading in a way. You wake up in the street one morning and the rebels will advance a couple of streets. Then end of the day, they will lose these two. It's a very, very fluid situation. And of course, you have the snipers, you have the shelling, you have the planes. It's very, very complicated and difficult.
And we should explain the context here. You were in for this front line in the city of Aleppo, which is a large city in northwestern Syria, right? Relatively close to the Turkish border, right?
It's in the northern part of Syria. It's close to the Turkish border. It's, if not the biggest city, and I think it's second after Damascus. It's the commercial hub of Syria. It's an ancient city, so you have, you know, the fighting was taking place in the new suburbs of Aleppo. But the heart of Aleppo is this ancient citadel that's been there for thousands of years.
Right. So this was house to house, street to street fighting, or I guess building to building, because a lot of these were large apartment buildings that we see in the documentary. Did the rebels immediately trust you? Do they welcome journalists?
Yes, the rebels are in this stage in the fight, and I have to stress, in this stage of the fight, where they really welcome journalists and they really want to, you know, show what's happening. So they would take you in, they would let you accompany them, and I think they would let you accompany them in a very dangerous way. So unlike other, you know, front lines when, you know, the commander would tell you, no, you can't go to the front line, and your job as a journalist is to keep pushing to go to the front line. In Syria, you want to go to the front line? Here you go. You walk down that street. So there is nothing holding you back from actually falling into the hands of, you know, the regime or someone else. And that's also another challenge, I think, in these, not only in Syria, but in this Arab Spring conflicts, Libya, Syria. There are no restraints to where you can go and what you can do.
Now, the rebels that we see in your documentary, none of them have helmets. It seems to me few, if any, have ballistics vests. They have mostly hand-carried weapons. You want to just describe maybe one of the firefights, one of the encounters in the city of Aleppo with the government forces?
Dave, not only they don't have helmets and flak jackets, they don't even have enough ammunition. I was with one fighter who had 11 bullets, and he was like roaming as a freelance fighter along the front line trying to pick up a fight with somewhere. So they're very, very unequipped. There's one skirmish when the rebels hear about an army unit moving down the road and they want to go and attack them. They go in the middle of the street, which is very, very courageous, on the back of pickup truck, firing machine gun fire. But then there is chaos. There is no military planning. There is no organization. Most of the skirmishes happen like a game of a cat and mouse. The tank is the cat. When the tank moves down the street, the rebels disperse, run away, try to ambush the tank. Meantime, there is shelling, mortars raining on them, the buildings themselves kind of being attacked by the tank. And then they fire an RPG. Sometimes they go into the middle of the street, the RPG launcher wouldn't work. Sometimes they get killed. In other conflicts, you meet people and then you hear they died after a few weeks, months, years. In Syria, you meet someone in the morning and they die in the end of the day. It was this, you know, as one of the officer was saying, the only thing we have plenty of to spend is men.
And you said that some of the rebels have less experience, military experience, than the journalists. Did you ever find yourself wanting to say, hey, wait a minute, you don't want to be out there or take the other side of the street or something like that?
You know, of course, you're a journalist. You're there to monitor. It's not my job to intervene in a military conflict. But yes, I mean, you hear kind of like mortars falling down, and you have to pull the people around you and say, you know, maybe we should go under a building or hide somewhere. At one point, it was very, very, you know, I don't want to use the word pathetic, but it's really pathetic. You stand in the street and there's this, you know, jet fighter kind of circling overhead, and they go and hide under a tree. You know, it's really sad. I mean, as if the tree would stop, you know, the shelling or the shrapnel. It's just this sense of fear that you know, wraps everyone, and you just want to hide. You just want to shrink. So even the tree, which will absolutely do nothing, is for them is a form of cover. As I said, because most of them are civilians, farmers, they're very, very courageous. They go into the middle of the street to fight, but they have no vision of what happens after they take that street. There is no military planning. There are no commanders. Even in this front line where I spend most of the time, 150 fighters probably belong to a dozen units. There is no overarching commander or plan for this front line.
The fighters that you did meet and talk to, what motivated them?
Some of them were Salafis, some jihadis, some secular. Most of them were just driven by, you know, the spirit of the Arab Spring, the spirit of the revolution. They were revolutionaries fighting to topple Assad because they wanted a form of dignity. They were tired of being ruled like sheep, enslaved by one family, one ruling party. We've heard so much about this kind of, you know, these kind of regimes in Iraq and Libya and other places. And Syria is a typical, you know, mukhabarat state, a secret police state. So they are really fed up with that, and they're fighting to drive that regime out of, you know, they're fighting to, I don't know, a sense of liberation, to liberate themselves, democracy, if you want to call it. Now, within that frame of mind, you have all different kind of groups and movements. You have Islamists fighting for a form of Islamic State. You have seculars, but mainly it's fighting for, they call it a revolution of dignity.
You know, one of the things that you hear and read about the Syrian resistance is the presence of al-Qaeda and other jihadists there. I'm sure it's hard to tell given, you know, how dispersed the fighting is. But what's your sense of how strong a current the jihadi fighters represent in the Syrian resistance?
The jihadis are a strong current in a way – stronger than what we saw in Libya, in a way totally different from Yemen, the revolution in Yemen. Yet they are one segment within different elements of the fight. Unlike in Iraq, where the jihadis, owned the resistance when they became the umbrella, Al-Qaeda became the umbrella, and most other groups entered, fought within that umbrella. In Syria, they are a smaller group. Everyone is armed, so the jihadis are not the strongest element in the street. Last week, there was a skirmish between a jihadi group and a quote-unquote secular group, and the jihadi commander was killed. So they are not the strongest element, yet they are a very strong element in the battle. But again, you have to remember, the Syrians at this moment, they are desperate for support from anyone. Again, we saw it in Iraq, we saw it in Libya, we saw it in other places. They are so desperate that they are, firing old ammunition smuggled from Iraq. They are buying weapons in exorbitant prices. So when a bunch of jihadis, foreigners, come with lots of cash, with weapons, and with expertise, and they offer their help, they would be mad to say no. They would tell you, let's take their support now, and we figure out in the future. Of course, it's very, very dangerous strategy, but that's what they have.
Gaith Abdul Ahad is a correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Pianist Ian Hobson, on faculty at the University of Illinois, is renowned in these parts for, among other things, performing complete cycles of various composers' piano music. Last season, he played all the solo piano works of Robert Schumann, and this season he will embark on the piano solo and chamber works of Johannes Brahms, beginning Wednesday night. Mr. Hobson will join me on the Tuesday edition of Live and Local. The show airs weekdays at 4 p.m. on FM 90.9.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Gaith Abdul Ahad. He is a veteran correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian. He has reported widely on conflicts in the Middle East. He's recently been reporting from the conflict in Syria. His work is featured in a new Frontline documentary, which airs on PBS stations tonight. You also reported from eastern Syria, far from Aleppo, and you reported on an al-Qaeda group there. Was the situation similar there, where you saw the jihadi fighters being a small but significant part of the opposition?
Yes, it was a very similar situation in eastern Syria. But in eastern Syria, you saw less foreigners. Most of the foreigners were there who came from Saudi through the shared border, or came from Iraq, or, few of them came from Yemen. One came from Afghanistan. In Aleppo, it's different because it's closer to the border of Turkey, so it's very easy for the foreigners, the Chechens, the Turks, even British, crossing the border was a very easy, just a hike across the hills. But in eastern Syria, Qaeda has existed there for a longer time. They've been there since the Iraq War. Some of the bases of the Qaeda in Iraq actually were in eastern Syria. Many of the young men in eastern Syria fought in Iraq. So sort of Al-Qaeda presence in eastern Syria is more... Has existed there for a longer time than northern Syria. Northern Syria is a new phenomenon.
And when you were in eastern Syria, what was your sense of the popular support that the al-Qaeda forces got?
They have popular support in eastern Syria. Again, these are tribes very similar to the Iraqi tribes. They're very Sunni. They're very conservative. So it's easier for al-Qaeda to exist in their midst. It's easier to spread the Salafi jihadi ideology. And that's very, very dangerous, of course. In northern Syria, the culture is different. The people are more tolerant, multicultural, multiracial there. So Al-Qaeda is a distinctive group. Their Salafi ideology is very, very distinctive from the rest of the population. In eastern Syria, they are spreading, faster, easier, and they've been there for a long time now.
And you've used the term Salafi several times. That's a traditional kind of fundamentalist kind of current of Islam?
That's, what we can call them, the ultra-conservative. They are very, very restrictive in the way they interpret Islam. They have a very specific ideology. Of course, not all the Salafis jihadis, but all the jihadis are Salafis. And if we're talking about that issue now, then we have to look into the whole map of the resistance in Syria. And we see, we were talking about the foreigners and the jihadis, but if we talk about the Salafis in general, the ultra-conservative, you see them as a, you know, probably 30-40% of all the fighting that's happening in Syria is a sort of Islamic in some way or some sort. Why? Because most of the support is coming, again, from the Gulf countries, from Saudi, from Qatar, who really espouse these ideologies. And again, they really have to take money from these countries because no one else is giving them money. I've met Syrian rebels who grow beards, who espouse this very conservative, radical rhetoric when they speak. In reality, they drink, they take drugs, they have nothing to do with Islam, but they have to adopt this ideology to get money and support.
Wow. So they're in effect posing as religiously observant in order to promote the opposition.
Dave, 90% of all the battalions in Syria have a very Sunni conservative name, not because 90% of the fighters are ultra-conservative Islamists, although this is what the Syrian regime and others would like to portray it, but because the support is coming through specific channels, and one of these channels, the Saudis. So you need to adopt a name. You can't go fight and call your name, like, I don't know, the secular fighters and expect money to come from the Saudis. You have to adopt a very religious outlook, religious beards and ideology and names just to get the support that you need.
You mentioned that help is coming from Saudi Arabia, and that some of the rebels, in effect, kind of market themselves to the as the kind of groups they think that the Saudis would like to support. Is that money from the Saudi government, from private organizations or religious groups?
Different sources of funding. The Saudis are providing different sources of funding. So you see Syrian expats working in Saudi Arabia, British Syrians. You see Syrian individuals, religious organizations. And I really suspect that with, you know, a lot of Saudi government support. I've met troubles who have met Saudi, Qatari officials. I don't see money coming out of Saudi without the Saudi government consent, especially after, you know, 9/11 and the whole issues of funding. And it's a very strange thing because I don't see Saudi and the Qataris as this, you know, democracy-loving regimes, yet they are playing a big role helping the rebels in Syria. And that's, that's creating all this cynical look towards the Syrian revolution. Many people in the Middle East think of it as a Saudi proxy war against Iran. And that's a very, very sad thing for the rebels and for the revolution itself.
In the documentary, we see some of the unit commanders in Aleppo, where you were near the front lines, arguing with each other about how to proceed pretty intensely. I mean, do you see this ever getting more coordinated?
There are attempts to coordinate these attacks. So you have the couple of battalions, bigger battalions have been created in the past few months. Of course, you have the Farouk in Homs. They have existed as a bigger battalion for almost more than a year now. There is the Tawheed Brigade, which is a collective of smaller battalions, Islamic battalions. You have a bigger organization, but still you don't have one commander, for example, for Aleppo. You don't have one commander for one front line. And it's a lack of, how do we call it? It's an exercise in democracy. Every single, rebel operation is an exercise in democracy. You see guys arguing, no, we fire the RPG now, no, we fire the bullets now, no, we go that street. And sometimes these skirmishes, these attacks unfold over like many, many hours because people keep arguing. You know, George Orwell in his book, Homage to Catalonia, he was basically describing a very similar scene between all these international leftist volunteers when they fought in Spain in the 1930s. You know, how do you move from becoming a revolutionary into becoming a disciplined fighter?
So you see a lot of passion, not much organization. Do you see this as a movement that could win?
I am sure Syria will not go back to the way it was, 2 years ago. Definitely, it will take a long time. I do see them winning because there is no way back for those people. They've left everything. They've decided to come and become fighters and fight in the streets of Aleppo. The longer the fighting takes. The more people will be killed, the more the fragmentation happens in the society. So it's a very, very, very difficult situation. I don't see them losing. I see them winning probably, but in a very long time.
You know, I have to say, one of the things that we in the West have heard a lot about what's going on in Syria is indiscriminate bombing and shelling by the government in response to protests and resistance. And it was interesting to me in watching your frontline that here you see government army, infantry, engaging in this neighborhood-to-neighborhood, block-to-block fighting. Is it significant that the government is sending its forces in to contest the rebels in a city rather than simply bombing from the air?
Well, the government has been sending troops for the past, you know, almost for the past 2 years. And if they can't do it by troops, they will do it by troops. They've been always sending tanks and troops and, you know, the government-sponsored militias. But when we were in the countryside of Syria, of Aleppo, you see, you know, most of the towns and the villages have been, you know, quote-unquote, liberated by the rebels. But the government still maintains specific bases in the middle of this liberated countryside. And every night they start, you know, shelling the villages and towns around them, lobbing shells. I don't know if it happens out of their frustration or because they just want to, you know, antagonize the rebels, scare the population. But they do it systematically, not only in Aleppo, everywhere in Syria. In the neighborhoods of Syria, you know, I stood with rebels around a street corner. They had, you know, very, very little ammunition. There were government troops in the end of the street. They had tanks and they had, you know, obviously lots of ammunition. But they're incapable of driving to the end of the street and retaking the street. I don't know why, because they don't have the same morale like the rebels, because they are scared of the rebels, because they're conscript soldiers and they don't see why should they fight and get killed in the street. But that's the situation. You see a bigger army, well-equipped, with lots of ammunition, incapable of taking, of retaking neighborhoods in Aleppo or in different parts of Syria from rebels who are less numbered and far less equipped.
Gaith Abdul-Ahad is a correspondent for The Guardian. His reporting is featured in a new Frontline documentary called The Battle for Syria, which premieres on PBS stations tonight. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater Company's The Government Inspector, September 13th through October 28th at Sydney Harmon Hall, Washington, D.C., and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories, with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Solid, reliable reporting has made the PBS NewsHour one of the most trusted news programs on television. Executive editor Jim Lehrer and his team of senior correspondents, including Judy Woodruff, Ray Suarez, and Gwen Ifill, bring you compelling original reports, in-depth analysis, and newsmaker interviews from the field. Get the straightforward story about what's happening in your world. Watch the PBS NewsHour live each weeknight at 6 on WILL-TV.
It's tough to be in two places at once, but reporters for The World go to hundreds of places.
For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Gaza City.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Rabat, Morocco.
Lahore, Pakistan.
Beirut. Istanbul.
In Baghdad. Listen to The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall, for public telecommunication.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who has the day off. We're speaking with Gaith Abdul Ahad, an Iraqi-born journalist who spent the past 9 years covering wars and conflict in the Middle East. He's reported on al-Qaeda camps in Yemen, Taliban fighters in Afghanistan, and rebels in Libya and Syria. He's featured in a new Frontline documentary called The Battle for Syria, which premieres on PBS stations tonight. We've seen a wave of anti-Western violence recently, of course, in a number of countries in the Middle East, in Cairo and in Libya, where Ambassador Christopher Stevens was killed. You wrote recently that this has little to do with the film which insulted the Prophet Muhammad. What's really going on here?
Well, initially, the kind of the demonstration, be it in Cairo and be it in Libya, these are manufactured events. Bunch of clerics, mullahs, who would like to drive religion into the daily political life. They would seize on an event. They will take the opportunity provided by this idiotic film, and then they will create an event, and that event will provide them with power, with a reason to go into the street and, you know, lead the masses, so to speak. That's the initial kind of couple of days. Once that happened, you see all the, you know, grievances that people in this region have against the West coming up to the surface, and people start demonstrating for everything from poverty, unemployment, anger against their regimes, into the West support to Israel, the, you know, Obama's drone wars, the Iraq war, Afghanistan. All these things collectively provide the, you know, the pretext, the reason for the anger you see in the streets. Is it about the insulting of the Prophet? I don't think so. Why you see only, you know, hundreds, thousands demonstrating in the street? Why don't you see 100 million people? You know, there are millions of Muslims around the world. So there are so many reasons for people of this region to be angry at the West. And no, it's not enough for Obama to have this new relationship with the Arab world. It's not enough. The grievances go, you know, are longer and deeper.
So are we in for a new era of anti-American and anti-Western hostility?
I don't think we ever ended the first era of anti-Western, you know, anti-colonialism to enter the new era. It's there. It will always bubble to the surface.
You know, the day after the attack that killed Ambassador Stevens, the New York Times reported that far, far larger crowds turned out to demonstrate sadness at his death and some support for the U.S. What do you make of that report?
Well, of course it's true. Far more people in Libya, in Tunis, in Cairo who actually support, especially in Libya, who support, what the ambassador was doing in Libya than the people who went, you know, storming the embassy or killing the poor guy. But the reality is those guys, the Salafis were, most of these demonstrations were led by the Salafis, and the Salafis were totally outfitted by this Arab Spring. They were, posing as the opposition to these oppressive regimes. They were saying for a long time, they and other Islamists, they were saying that Islam is the solution, that Islam provides the path for the revolution. But the revolution was never about having an Islamic state. Those Salafis want to come back into the surface. And they find in this film as an opportunity, be it in Libya, they find in the jihadi movements in Syria now as an opportunity for them to come on the surface. So you have to see it within the prism of that thing. It's not Again, there are so many grievances against the West, but not necessarily the reason for this demonstration. We are not entering a new era of anti-American feelings. It has nothing to do with American elections and has nothing to do with the Obama administration. It has to do with the Salafis agitating and frustration in the streets of the Middle East pouring into the streets.
A big question for American policymakers is whether it should be intervene more directly in the conflict in Syria. I mean, to supply weapons or create a no-fly zone. And, there is this very touchy question. As you say, there are many grievances against the West in many Muslim countries and a lot of resentment at American troops being in Muslim countries. And, of course, we saw this horrific, bloody sectarian war that followed the U.S. invasion in Iraq. What's your read of what American approach might be most productive in Syria?
I don't know what's most productive would be for the Americans to do in Syria, but I think they are taking the worst approach at the moment. They are not, openly supporting the rebels, while they are from under the table, coordinating with the rebels, letting their allies send them a trickle of weapons. The weapons are neither enough for the rebels to win nor for them to be defeated. So you have this prolonged conflict, and mainly because of not only the West, but the whole international community paralysis over the Syrian situation. For months, the activists, the people were demonstrating in the streets, but no one wanted to touch the Syrian uprising because they feared it might change the balances in the Middle East. Then the Syrians decided to, pick up arms and start fighting and move it into an insurgency. And now suddenly you have an insurgency under your hand and you don't know what to do. And the next step will have a civil war and no one would know what to do. So I think a big opportunity was missed when the activists were not supported, with the paralysis of the international community, allowing Russia, China, Iran to play a huge, big role in this conflict, allowing the Saudis and Qataris to sponsor, militias and send weapons. So you're neither supporting the rebels nor you're, stopping this conflict. It's a worse situation you have at this moment. So to be honest, I don't know what's the perfect solution. What I see on the ground now is a mess.
We're speaking with Gaith Abdul Ahad. He's a correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Lots of people have stereotypes about counterculture.
It wasn't all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There were serious things happening. The other stuff was happening too. There were serious things happening.
University Laboratory High School students interviewed 16 local residents about their experiences with counterculture. Listen to their stories in Beyond the Tie-Dye, Counterculture in Champaign-Urbana, 1965-75, September 22nd at 6 p.m. on WILL AM 580.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Gaith Abdul Ahad. He is a correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian. He is Iraqi-born and has reported widely on conflicts in the Middle East. His reporting on the conflict in Syria will be featured in a new Frontline documentary, which airs on PBS stations tonight. I'd like to hear a little bit about your own experience. As I understand it, you got into this business by initially translating for Western journalists in Iraq. Is that right?
Yes, it was the day after Baghdad fell in 2003, and I, claimed that I was a British journalist and walked through, 10 American checkpoints into the palace, what's now the Green Zone. I really wanted to see the palace of Saddam. How did he live? Who were those people who ruled us for so long? And then on the way out, I hitched a ride with, with a Western journalist, James Meek, with The Guardian, and he's now one of my greatest friends. And I started working as his assistant translator, and I just realized I love this. I love to, meet people and talk and then tell a story. I think, that day I stopped being an architect, and I think I started the process of being a journalist.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your life before then. I mean, how did you learn to speak English so fluently?
I was an architect in Baghdad. I studied architecture. I finished school and I decided, you know, to dodge military service and not to join the army. And I spent, you know, many years in Baghdad just changing my apartment, moving from one place to the other, faking ID cards and stuff. And that, you know, probably that experience helped me a lot later when I became a journalist. I learned English in 2001, 2002. I was, you know, tired of reading history in my history. And I'm sorry to say that, but most of our history books are driven either by ideology or by, you know, you can rarely read honest Arab history books in Arabic. So I decided to learn English to read about my history in another language. And things start moving from there.
Wow. You know, I'm sure your fluency in Arabic was an enormous edge in a lot of the reporting that you've done. But I also imagine that people detect regional accents and dialects. And I wonder if there are times when you're in, you know, Yemen or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Libya where people can hear that you're an Iraqi and whether that makes a difference.
Sometimes you wish you're a foreigner, I tell you. Sometimes you wish you're American in certain conflicts. You know, in Syria, for example, it's not very good to be an Iraqi. The Iraqi government's taking a huge standing on the side of the government. They're supporting the government, so it's not very good to be an Iraqi. The same thing in probably Yemen and other places. But then it's a thing you learn in Iraq. You learn how to switch your accents. For example, during the civil war in Iraq, you know, when you reported in western Baghdad, you had to speak with a Sunni dialect. When you cross the lines and you go report in Sadr city in eastern Baghdad, you had to switch your accent and you speak like a Shia. The same thing happens in all of these, you know, situations with civil wars. I know Lebanese friends, Lebanese journalists who had, you know, had to switch their accents during the Lebanese civil war. Same thing happening now in Syria, for example. If you're Alawite, if you're a Sunni, how do you cross a checkpoint? I think it's a skill you learn very early in your life, how to pass a checkpoint. It's a very, very difficult and dangerous situation. And I saw it in front of me in Aleppo this time. I saw a man coming into the rebels thinking they were government soldiers and start praising the government and denouncing the rebels. And he was, you know, taken and beaten up and tortured.
So you look at your career. I mean, you covered these horrific events in Iraq. I mean, you were among the Al-Qaeda in Yemen. You were with the Taliban in Pakistan, where it was kidnapped. While you were covering the conflict in Libya, you were captured by the Gaddafi regime and held for, I think, about 2 weeks, right?
Yes.
I have to ask, why do you continue to do this risky stuff? Do you think about maybe it's time to do something a little more conventional?
Well, I would love to cover the wine industry in south of Spain, but I don't see that making a very interesting story. You know, I mean, there is something very interesting in these places. That those guys do have a very interesting story to tell. It's very, most of the time, they're kind of put in a corner and then their story is told in a very conventional way, if we can say that. I'm very, very interested in who those guys are. Why do you become a fighter with Al-Qaeda in Yemen? Because there is some local politics going on in the background. It's not because you woke up one morning and you decided to become Al-Qaeda fighter and go attack the United States. Why do you become a Taliban fighter? Why do you fight in the streets of Aleppo if you really love food and your kids and you want to spend time with your family? There is something that drives those men to become fighters, and I want to tell that story in a way. I don't know if I've succeeded in doing that, but this is what I aspire to do.
Well, I think a lot of your writing is in fact quite personal, and you really take us inside the homes and streets and minds of these folks that you meet. Have you become more cautious? Have you learned how to stay out of more dangerous situations?
You know, when I first started covering Iraq or covering the war in Iraq, the sounds of bullets were just a backdrop to what you're doing in the streets. Now, in Aleppo, in Syria, like every bang is associated with a metal object flying somewhere, and you really want to keep your head down. So I would love to say that I'm more cautious now, but in the end of the day, this is a war situation. And, you know, you think you're in control, but reality is you're there in the middle of all these different elements.
So you got into journalism after the American invasion, and you saw such horrific things happen to your country. I'm wondering kind of what, I don't know, it's a big question, but what's your take on where Iraq has come and where it is today? Do you spend time there?
Yes, of course, I spend time in Iraq. You know, one thing you do when, and I think I was very lucky in that is, I looked at Iraq as, you know, as an outside experience. So I was Iraqi. I grew up in Iraq all my life. I'm Iraqi. I speak the language. But when I covered Iraq, I tried to do it as a foreigner covering a foreign country. Otherwise, you know, I would be too passionate, I'll be too angry, I'll be too frustrated, and I won't be able to do it. So I tried to see it as a different country, as a foreign country, as what happens to the people when their country is occupied, when the fighting happens in the streets, and when a regime like that, like this, is installed. So I think Iraq now is in a very, very bad place. It's a mafia state. It's ruled by, you know, by a very, very corrupt mafia. And I don't mean only the prime minister and his party. I mean even the opposition are no better. Everyone is corrupt. You have this clique of politicians, army generals, their bodyguards, their militia commanders, who have total monopoly on the state, the wealth of the state. I mean, we're talking about a country with a budget of $100 billion in the past few years. Yet when you drive in the streets of Baghdad, it's the same miserable, it's the same festering garbage, the same sewage overflowing in the streets. The corruption is massive. There is no state of law, you know. No one is immune. You can be detained in the street, tortured, captured, interrogated. You confess to whatever crime they tell you to confess, and then your family has to pay a huge bribe to get you released. So it's a horrible state. I'm more scared when I cover Iraq than I'm, you know, in Syria or in Libya.
How much of this do you lay at the feet of the U.S. invasion? I mean,
you know, people ask me when I'm in the Middle East, and this is my dilemma. Sometimes I really hate it, and they always ask me the same question. You know, every taxi in every other Middle Eastern country, they ask you the same question. Oh, you're Iraqi, so was it better under Saddam or after the American occupation? And as if you don't have any choice, either a mad dictator or a crazy occupation, you know. You should have a third choice. Of course I blame the American occupation. Of course I blame them for many things. You know, the occupation itself is a crime. Who can occupy a country in this day and age? Yet to blame everything happening now and put it at the feet of the Americans is unfair. This is a long history of coups and corrupt states and corrupt dictators and you know, Saddam and before Saddam and after Saddam and the invasion of Kuwait. And so the Americans share part of the blame like every other player in the history of Iraq. They are not the sole perpetrator of the miserable situation now in Iraq. The Iraqis themselves, you know, they voted for these political parties and they voted on a sectarian basis. So they do share the part of the blame too. But the occupation was a disaster.
You've had a fascinating cultural journey yourself, and you wrote an interesting piece about, it might have been the first time you went to London, I think, and you went to the Glastonbury Music Festival. What was this like for you, coming from a place like Iraq and experiencing London?
It's still a fascinating thing for me when I go to a place and I see a huge crowd of people just having good time. This is a fascinating thing. I mean, I just have this huge smile on my face, be it Glastonbury, be it anywhere else in the world. When you see a huge crowd of people, even in Istanbul, you know, on a beautiful sunny day, you see families, people taking their baskets, their food, their grilling equipment, and filling the parks, side streets. This, you know, it's an amazing feeling to see a huge group of people just having a good time. The way I see it, the way I saw it in my country, whenever you see a huge crowd of people, it's always associated with some form of anger or some form of demonstration or even religious expression in a very, very violent way. So this is still my cultural shock when I see a massive amount of people just having a good time.
Well, let's hope it happens in Iraq someday.
I hope so.
Well, Gaith Abdul Ahad, I hope you stay safe, and I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Gaith Abdul Ahad is a correspondent for The Guardian. His reporting is featured in the new Frontline documentary, The Battle for Syria, which premieres on PBS stations tonight. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews jazz pianist Brad Meldow's new trio album of pop covers. This is Fresh Air.
Has someone ever invited you over just to listen to music? Were they all excited about something they wanted you to hear? So much so that not only did you get to hear some great music, but you had a great time together? This is Vic DiGeronimo. I have hundreds of years worth of great music that I'm excited about sharing with you. And I guarantee you that we'll have a great time listening together. I'd like to invite you to join me Monday through Friday mornings from 9 until noon for Classic Mornings on FM 90.9.
WILO programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
From events halfway around the globe to right in your backyard, keep up to date on the issues and ideas affecting your life right here every day on AM 580.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says there's nothing special anymore about jazz musicians playing post-Beatles pop. It's just the new normal. One of the trendsetters on that score was pianist Brad Meldow, playing Radiohead and Nick Drake tunes. Meldow's trio has a new covers album, and Kevin has this review.
Brad Meldow, bringing out all the melancholy in Elvis Costello's Baby Plays Around. It's on Meldow's new trio CD of songs by other people, Where Do You Start?, recorded at the Sessions for last spring's all-originals album, Ode. Good as that one was, I like the new one a little more, most of it anyway, not least for the unlikely selections. His take on Got Me Wrong by Alice in Chains owes something to the young Keith Jarrett's piano grooving. But Meldow's not imitating anybody. His trio, with bassist Larry Grenadier and drummer Jeff Ballard, has its own distinct profile. There's something a bit odd about how the chords leap around in Alice in Chains' Got Me Wrong. The rock, folk, and pop tunes Meldow picks all have some musical facets improvisers can dig into. The trio aren't slumming. Meldow loves Nick Drake's whispered melodies, like Time Has Told Me, which starts on a simple two-chord vamp before wandering out of key. Even Hey Joe, one of the first tunes 60s kids learned on guitar, traces a jazzy circle of fifths chord progression. At the climax, bass and Meldow's left hand shout out to the Jimi Hendrix version. ¶¶ Brad Meldow's new Where Do You Start also includes that Barbra Streisand weeper and songs from Cuba and Brazil. The one jam session standard, Sonny Rollins' Aerogen, brings out some of Meldow's fastest and hippest playing, his and the rhythm sections. The pianist builds his improvisation like a master storyteller. He keeps you hanging in to see how the next twist resolves and brings you back just when you think he's lost you. His left hand supplies just enough atmosphere to color the tale. Brad Meldow is a hell of a piano player, but he doesn't always grab me. That Elvis Costello tune goes into a long, out-of-tempo solo section that dilutes its effect. He'll coast once in a while, as if just playing hip tunes is enough. Sufjan Stevens' Holland takes forever to get going and then doesn't go very far. Sometimes, it's as if Meldow's playing for folks who stop off for a quick one on the way home from the office. But then he'll play something so richly inventive, those folks will wind up missing their train home, and the one after that.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure, Downbeat, and E-Music, and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Where Do You Start, the new album by the Brad Meldow Trio on the Nonesuch label. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Associate producer Heidi Simon is handling our online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change, at ajws.org. This is NPR.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at subaruofchampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
It's 11:59, and stick around. The Afternoon Magazine is coming up next here on listener-supported public radio, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. And in the Afternoon Magazine, we'll have an hour of news and information for you from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media. And among the stories we're following at this hour, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union says people should not expect a quick decision when union delegates gather today to decide whether to end a 7-day strike. Also, two groups say more than half the people in Illinois and 38 other states will be obese by the year 2030. We'll tell you about those stories and much more. We'll also have the latest installment of the Beyond the Tie-Dye series, reports on 60s counterculture from students from University Laboratory High School. Let's update you now on what's happening in the commodity market, starting with Kansas City wheat for December. It's trading at $8.97, down 4.25. March wheat's at $9.08.5, down 4.25. Chicago wheat for December is at $8.72.5, down 5.5. March wheat at $8.84.75, down 5.5. December corn's at $7.44.5, down 3.25. Make that 74,